Hello and welcome to the Majlis Radio Free Arab Liberties Current Affairs Podcast focusing on Central Asia. I am Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Arab Liberties Media Manager and host of the Majlis Podcast here in Washington, D.C. So let me say a couple of words here. First, as a Majlis Podcast, we are back in Turkmenistan after a long time. Second, when we went to sleep last night, the topic we had in mind was Turkmenistan's recent energy outreach in diplomacy. So we will still talk about that, certainly, which is very important given the recent visit by the Taliban. But in the meantime, President Berdimuhamedov just appointed his son vice prime minister of the country, which was rather striking. It's often a challenge to make sense of certain developments in Turkmenistan, but his rise was rapid in taking place in the daylight. I guess the timing and what it means for the country and the question of succession might be interesting development to watch going forward. And we have the right panel to talk about all of them. And let me welcome our speakers today. So joining us from London is Dr. Luka Ancheschi, Central Asia lecturer at the University of Glasgow. Dr. Luka is the author of many important publications on Turkmenistan, including a book on the country's status of neutrality. Stanislav Prichin is joining us from Moscow, who is a senior researcher at the Institute of World Studies, and Farukh Yusupi, the director of Radio Free Arab Liberties Turkmen Service. Farukh is joining us from Prague, along with Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Arab Radio Liberties Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you very much, colleagues, for joining us today. So let's start with Serdar's appointment. Farukh, I got the news about a president's decision to appoint his son to the position of vice prime minister from your news feed today in the morning. So I will give credit to you for breaking the news about this. We know that he has been groomed for a big role, but it was rather soon, at least to me, or maybe not. Was there any sign that this is coming?
Yes, I mean, we've been waiting for this. I mean, he was appointed minister last year, like exactly 1 year ago. And earlier this week, our correspondent told, based on a source, that he's going to be appointed as the chief of the Chamber of Auditors. And we couldn't confirm it. And I thought, like, why Chamber of Auditors? It's going to be, I mean, probably demotion from the ministerial position. But then yesterday, the official information confirmed that making this position higher profile, because it will be combined with the position of the deputy prime minister. And they created this additional deputy prime minister, minister's position, was especially for Serdar. And not only that, but he will be a member for the first time. The head of the auditorial chamber will be a member of the Security Council of the country. So, I mean, in fact, he elevated his son to be one of the top officials in the government.
Can we say this? Is it safe to say, like, he is now legally second in command after his dad?
I don't know what the hierarchy is in the, because there are other deputy prime ministers of the government. They don't have this first deputy prime ministers or like ordinary deputy prime. All of them are deputy prime ministers. There are now at least four of them, including Serdar, or five, or even five. So, but from the look of it, he will be the second in command. I mean, as a given fact, like officially, probably not, but as a fact, he is. I mean, so far we know that. I mean, most influential person, of course, president himself, but second influential person was Meredov, and we will see if Meredov will go to the back row. And how Serdar's role would be, will be more outlined. And we have to remember that they are going to have elections next month, end of next month, first elections after they introduce the system of the bicameral parliament.
It's for parliamentary elections.
Yeah, parliamentary elections. Mm-hmm. There are two chambers of parliament now, starting from January 1st of this year. And that will be a big step forward.
They are squeezing
transfer of power.
Yeah, they are squeezing too many things into a short time frame. Dr. Luka, you know, you studied Turkmenistan, is very complex situation. What stands out to you?
Well, I must admit, I'd never believed that we could accelerate so quickly towards some kind of dynastic succession. I'm clean. I've been skeptical, and Bruce Barnier knows this very well because I chat with him all the time. So it is surprising. But the reality is that we now have the president, Sam, being one of the deputy prime ministers. So if not, it's the number two constitutionally, is the number two in real terms. It's something which we never seen so visibly in Central Asia before. I mean, we got a situation in Tajikistan where the president is grooming his son, but this is kind of legitimized by the law. So to me, it seems that there is now a landscape in which, if and when Berdimuhamedov goes, we're going to have another Berdimuhamedov. My understanding is that people who have researched other scenarios in which you did have dynastic succession, that's mostly Azerbaijan in our part of the world, the part of the world which we study, is that you do have that kind of centrality of your son or your daughter, your son in this case, if you're a president, when there are competing interests within the elite. So having Serdar there is a kind of a insurance policy, maybe for Berdimuhamedov, or maybe in order to respond to the sudden deterioration of the presidential power, because the economic crisis is very bad, because the situation is what it is. I mean, the COVID situation must have eroded even further the way in which people relate to these regimes.
Interesting. Thank you, Dr. Luca. Very interesting points. So, meantime, I was also wanted to request all of you, please keep your remarks as brief as it makes sense, because we need to cover lots of grounds within 35, 40 minutes. Now, building on what Dr. Luca has just said, Bruce and Stanislaw, I'm coming to you. I was also thinking about his age. He's just 39 years old, young man. Maybe I'm kind of overemphasizing on his age. You know, we had President Kennedy becoming the U.S. president at the age of 43. So maybe age is not a factor in what we are talking about today. But the context is important and also different, given Serdar is basically groomed and appointed to this role, versus in other cases, like in the case of Kennedy, they got elected after a grueling election process. So I think the most pressing question here is, maybe is he ready for this role, given Turkmenistan is currently going through so much, as Farrukh and Dr. Luca has said. Bruce, Stanislaw, just feel free to jump in, whoever wants to take this question first.
Go ahead, Stanislaw.
Okay, so I think that in any case, Serdar is probably the most experienced and the best educated politician in Turkmenistan. In comparison with other ministers, he, in his career, has had so much different positions with real responsibility for his job. And from this point of view, more probably, he started his career when his father was not the president. So in such circumstances, of course, he had different period of his careers, not just when his father was the number one person and the number one stakeholder in his country.
You think so?
In such circumstances, of course, we are witnesses of the preparation of dynastic scenario of the transit of power, but who knows when it might happen. In such circumstances, of course, probably today he is not ready to be next president. But in the future, of course, taking into account all of his experience, he studied in Russian Diplomatic Academy. He studied in Geneva Security Center of Security Policy. I studied there as well, and I had an opportunity to talk with his teacher about Serdar, and he recommended him as very responsible and very smart and an open-minded person. It was very interesting to hear it from the first hand. So I probably might be a little bit in the position with my previous speakers, because to Turkmenistan, from my point of view, Serdar might be the best person who might lead this country, especially in comparison with his father.
Stanislaw, would you allow me to bring in Bruce here? I mean, you are putting something very, very interesting. I feel we are going to have a very interesting discussion today. So what do you think, Bruce, as per the Stanislaw's comment about Serdar's experience? And he says that he might be the best person, the way it stands currently in Turkmenistan, to be in this position.
Definitely some interesting comments, and I hadn't really considered it from that point of view. My my big problem with him is that I'm not sure he has the character to become the president of Turkmenistan, because there's kind of a mold for being the president of Turkmenistan so far, which is not to say that he couldn't break it, and people are hoping he does. But if you look at what they've had their whole history of independence, you know, it's been this kind of a, not just a strongman, but kind of a loony, crazy strongman or something, you know. And so the domestic politics of the country are something that are very different than in neighboring Central Asian states. I mean, everything obviously centers around the president, but big family has business interests, you know, all over the place too. It's kind of a cutthroat world in which the president is the one that ultimately holds the big knife to cut the throats, I suppose. You know, when I look at Serdar, I mean, even the looks on his face, he doesn't look like he has the kind of confidence you would need to pull off the kind of strongman rule that Turkmenistan has had. And I've heard these comments too from other people that he was at least basically a good guy, you know, when he was outside the country. And we know that his dad's been working on him and trying to get him to be mean. And there's reports that he'd go into places and, you know, curse at people and threaten people and stuff at certain governments, agencies and businesses and stuff. But like I said, it doesn't seem like it's his character. You have to be a unique kind of person to take over Turkmenistan, which is, again, not to say that maybe he couldn't change everything in another direction, but we haven't seen that yet.
But what about his competency, Bruce, as a vice prime minister? I mean, given that there is no prime minister's position in Turkmenistan, so it is rather an important position, right? You know, and being just a nice guy might not cut, you know, this is an important role.
I know they've been trying to toughen him up because I've heard a lot of the rumors, you know, where they really want him to be a lot tougher. But on the other hand, look at the position he's in. You know, I mean, he's the son of the president. So you would think that when he went into, especially the way Turkmenistan works, anywhere he goes, any building he goes into, any crowd or group of people that he encounters are going to be afraid of him, you know, because of who his dad is. So that doesn't really breed the kind of stern character that you need. If people are unwilling, you don't have to bully them so much because they've already been bullied and they're terrified of you when you show up. Without his dad, though, that might not be the case. You know, that's going to be the big question. If he gets put into power, is he enough of a fighter? Is he going to be able to hold on to that position?
Let's jump in.
Sure.
I'm not really questioning whether or not Serdar is qualified, is educated, but I think that there is a problem, is that we need to contextualize what's happening in Turkmenistan with what we've seen in the last 5 years in Central Asia, where we had two transitions, Uzbekistan 2016 and Kazakhstan 2019, where if the successor does not change some kind of policy and policies, the people are not happy. That's the big missed opportunity of the Tokayev change. So my question for everyone, I mean, and even for you, Mohammed, if you want, would be, is Serdar going to change the dynamics of this country? Or are we going to have another signal of continuity from a very authoritarian regime? It's not about qualification.
Very good question.
Luca, I can speculate on that, if you allow me. I see what's going to happen is, I mean, being a nice guy or a good guy or even an experienced guy will not probably work in Turkmenistan's conditions, because the rule of Niyazov and Berdimuhamedov brought the country to the stage when any newcomer, especially Berdimuhamedov's son, will have to be tougher and will have to impose more brutal rule, more brutal dictatorship in order to keep power. And I assume he will want to keep power because his life and life of his family will depend on that. If you remember, like 14 years ago, when Berdimuhamedov came and he gave some hopes for openness, everyone thought that he was a reformer. But look where we are now. I can only speculate that poor Turkmens, it's not going to be easy for them.
Stanislav, I cut you earlier. Yeah, go ahead.
Of course, political system in Turkmenistan, of course, it's a very, very particular, peculiar point, in any case, even in Central Asia. And of course, this country should be under very, very strong men. But personally, if we consider Serdar as a potential successor of his father, we, of course, should take into account differences in his career. Berdimuhamedov didn't live abroad. He didn't see any other system, and for him, the only way of living and ruling was his president. In case of Serdar, we could see a little bit different experience with connection with other people, And this, of course, give us a little bit hopes for positive expectation. Of course, not changing all system, but from the point of view of rule of law, of, for example, rights of protection rights of investors. From this perspective, we could expect some elements of positive changes. Of course, it will be very, very strong test of the process of transition of power. Okay. Of course, last time it was absolutely unexpected result. Nobody considered Berdimuhamedov as the number one candidate. Of course, in the future, but legitimization of the being a son of the president, this is a very strong argument in fighting for the number one position in Turkmenistan.
Yeah. Again, you know, we're kind of talking about the succession type of questions here, but I mean, we also don't know even the situation reaches to that point. I mean, Berdimuhamedov doesn't seem to me from his outlook that he's going to step aside for a long time to come. So since this question was brought in a couple of times, and I guess Bruce used that word, and Luca, I also heard from you. I mean, is it really what we are talking about now with his appointment as the vice prime minister? I mean, is it what it is happening? Or at least we are in the preparation period towards the direction? Is it what disappointment is saying?
All right, well, I'll jump in first. This is the big question, of course. And unfortunately, it brings up the perennial rumor of what is the state of Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov's health. When he started to have health problems years ago, his son's career, at least in the Turkmen government, kind of parallels his father's health problems, right? When the first time he started to have problems, and we heard that he'd gone into a diabetic coma, you know, Serdar became a deputy in parliament not long after that. And Farouk can correct me if I'm wrong with the chronology there, but it was sometime right around there too. And so that really started this whole process. Now, for all appearances, Berdimuhamedov seems to be in pretty good health, although we know that everything is so well managed in Turkmenistan, any of his appearances, that you're never really sure, you know, if this wasn't 5 good minutes of a horrible day for him or something that they put on TV. He has had 2 visits from that team of German doctors that have shown up. Now, they could have been there to see his parents, I suppose, or something, but we kind of assume that they came out to see him because they got into Ashgabat right away, which shows that whatever reason they were there for, it was something really important. And more than likely, the one guy is Berdimuhamedov's doctor, you know, and they showed up twice since late November. So that makes you at least consider that something might be up, because if he was in really good health and they showed up once, they did a checkup, they left, they didn't come back, but they came back a few weeks later. You know, again, these rumors of Central Asian leaders being on their deathbeds have been around for so long that you get tired of even bringing it up. But for what it's worth, it doesn't seem like everything's right there at the moment.
Very interesting conversation so far, by the way. So how does this appointment factors in some of the recent developments that Turkmenistan was going through in the energy sector, such as the energy diplomacy that includes Turkmenistan seeking even Taliban's endorsement in some of those projects, and what to look for and what comes next in that direction? So let's continue the conversation talking about this and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast. I am joined by Dr. Luca Enchesci, a Central Asia Studies lecturer at the Glasgow University, Stanislav Prichin, a senior researcher at the Institute of World Studies, joining us from Moscow today, and Farukh Yusufidi, director of Radio Free Europe Liberties Turkmen Service, joining us from Prague, Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe Liberties Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. I'm Mohamed Tahir, Radio Free Europe Liberties media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing Turkmenistan and trying to make sense of the recent developments, like the decision of the Turkmen president to appoint his son as vice prime minister and recent energy diplomacy. Welcome back, colleagues. So let me tune in to the discussion about the energy diplomacy with Serdar's appointment. Any connection, Dr. Luca, do you see between the recent efforts on the energy outreach front with the Taliban, with Azerbaijanis, and disappointment?
If you believe Turkmen propaganda, these guys have in 2 or 3 weeks fixed both the Trans-Caspian pipeline and the TAPI pipeline, which is unrealistic to say the least. So I think that what this constant search for news, for success, really reveals the fact that they are in a cul-de-sac when it comes to the energy policy. They have got nowhere to go. because the 2009 pipeline, the one that went to China, has created 10 years down the track exactly the same situation that they had in the 1990s and 2000 when they only traded with Russia and a little bit with Iran. So I would say that I've been watching Turkmenistan for 20 years, so I got a bit of an experience there. And my sense is that this constant search for new routes and, you know, the claiming success, which is not really there, because I was reading today that TAP is going to start now in 2023, which should have finished 5 years ago, so, but it doesn't matter. So this kind of constant search for new routes really reveals the deeply uncomfortable position in which the regime finds itself. This is one resource economy selling one product to one customer only.
But Dr. Luke, I'm just driving you towards the conversation that they had with the Taliban leadership the other day. If you look, the press statements came out from that meeting. It looks like Taliban is sort of supporting the idea of Trans-Afghan pipeline. Again, this is one of the projects that you were indirectly mentioning that Turkmenistan was engaged for a long time. So it looks like to me, at least on that front, there was little bit of an improvement or progress because of the meeting with the Taliban leadership.
Well, it could be, but we haven't really heard about who's going to pay for it. Mm. The profit structure of the pipeline, the demand structure, is India and Pakistan going to buy as much as they say they would? It's a big question. This is not a short pipeline. This is very long. It's very expensive. It goes through profoundly unsafe territory. So it seemed to me this is just a new page in an old book. I'm sorry if I'm cynical, but, you know, I worked on it for a couple of years, and it seemed to me that is more the same.
Mm. Okay. So, Stanislav, you look into energy more than many of us do. So what was the Taliban outreach about, and how do you read if there was anything achieved from that meeting?
I don't think that we could expect something breakthrough from this meeting and from any developments around TAPI, because this is not just about security in Afghanistan. Of course, this is a crucial question. Hmm. But the problem of credibility of Pakistan as the main purchaser of this gas. So we have ready pipeline from Iran to Pakistan, but it doesn't work because Pakistan doesn't have money for purchasing Iranian gas.
Again, there is also a political issue there, Stanislav. I mean, Iran being under sanctions.
But there is a pipeline to the border with Pakistan. So you have very strong and stable without security issues like in Afghanistan a pipeline for your demands, and you doesn't use it. Not just about politics, but from my point of view, also economy issues. Mm. Indian-Pakistani relations also doesn't give them any positive expectations.
That's
from this project. So general geopolitics around TAPI, without even security in Afghanistan, this is a very, very bad scenario in any case.
But But outside of politics, though, Stanislav, what about Taliban's open support for this pipeline? Perhaps it was there, but now it is open and official. They say they support it. I mean, does it make any difference?
If we take a look at the map of TAPI, Kandagar, but before Kandagar, this pipeline should cross areas which are not under control of Taliban. And in such circumstances, Taliban is not only one guarantor of security of this project. In such circumstances, in situation of fragmentation, security issues in Afghanistan, it is impossible to have just one strong power who could protect this project from the economic point of view.
That's a very interesting point that you brought in, Stanislav Bruce. I also thought it was very interesting that Turkmenistan is engaged in such a policy-level discussion with a militant group based in Afghanistan without Afghan authorities present in the room. I'm sure, you know, they have spoken to Afghan officials about this project in numerous other occasions, but nevertheless, I thought it was interesting. Turkmenistan doesn't often do things like that. Anything stand out to you from that perspective?
Well, I mean, you know, okay, first I should mention that they certainly have been in touch with Afghan authorities. Mm-hmm. I mean, they opened that electric line in January, and both Ghani and Berdi Muhammadov were participated via video link. So they've certainly talked about this before. You know, the first thing I would say is the Taliban promise is worthless. Mm-hmm. You know, the promise of protecting infrastructure and keeping away from attack hacking it was made more than 4 years ago, and they've wrecked so many power pylons, and you know, you could just go on and list all the things. So the fact that they say that they won't attack the TAPI pipeline doesn't mean anything to me at all. Hmm. I don't think it should to anybody who wants to seriously participate in this project. That's no guarantee in my book. I dismissed that. Well, and of course, I dismissed that as even being the reason that the delegation was in Ashgabat. It sounds good, and it's what the Turkmen government wanted them to say for the outside world to hear. You know, Stanislav mentioned there's a lot of problems beyond the security problems in Afghanistan, but the security problems there are enough. Like I wrote in the paper, who's going to build this project? And Lucas said, who's going to sink money into this? If you're a worker for a company that makes pipelines, are you going into Afghanistan to sit there? What if the Taliban give you a guarantee and they're taking a battlefield whipping, you know, and they're getting beat in the battle, and they decide the best course of action is to hide behind the international construction workers so they don't get wiped out, droned, bombed, whatever? You know, I mean, it's just ridiculous to even try to imagine that anyone would take that guarantee seriously coming from the Taliban.
So what Turkmenistan was trying to do by inviting them, of course, you know, I want to believe that they might also be thinking from the direction that you are thinking, I mean, which is really logical what you are saying, Bruce. So what was the Turkmenistan's intention by inviting them?
You know, I mean, like I said, this is the big question. I personally don't believe it was TAPI. You know, and as I wrote in the paper with Abu Bakr, you know, that Turkmenistan has offered many times to host peace talks, Afghan peace talks, but they didn't mention that at all in this last meeting. So I'm convinced it's something that exists already, which is what I said, that there actually is electricity exports going to Afghanistan, and some of it is going to areas under the Taliban control, and some of it is going through areas that are under Taliban control, and Turkmenistan needs money. And so I think what it was more about was, you know, you'll still get the electricity you want. Don't shut off the electricity to people to government areas where we're getting paid. Mm. And you guys should also pay for the electricity that you're collecting fees on, too.
Yeah,
you know, just more immediately, we need money now, and we can get money, but you're standing in our way.
Yeah.
We're not taking sides, and we're not against you or anything. So, yeah.
Farooq will correct us if we are wrong in that. I mean, I guess in terms of the Turkmen electricity coming into Afghanistan, I mean, I guess the Taliban also taxing that electricity, I guess, right?
Yes, in the large areas in the northwest of Afghanistan, they're controlling large areas, and they take the payment from the local populations. And I would also add that, I mean, I agree with Bruce, that the question should be not why Turkmenistan invited them. The question should be what did Taliban do to compel Turkmenistan to invite them? I think it was more of a PR stunt for Taliban than Turkmenistan. From how Turkmen officials were behaving, you could see that they were trying to distance themselves from the fact that the Taliban delegation visited Ashgabat. They only gave a short report on the website of foreign ministry. Huh. They didn't report it on the TV. And even the foreign ministry's website didn't post pictures only of the Taliban members without showing any Turkmen officials and even naming any Turkmen officials who met with a Taliban delegation. Whereas the foreign minister himself, Rashid Miradov, met.
It sounds to me very, very awkward the way it's being treated. I mean, from the Taliban's perspective, of course, I guess before Turkmenistan, I guess they also went to Russia. They also went to Iran. Of course, they want to give this picture of that they are engaged with the, you know, international players. For them, of course, any stage is good stage. I think we need to move on. Just there's another point that I wanted to bring in here. So the timing was kind of interesting in a sense that there was also some sort of an agreement between Turkmenistanis and Azerbaijanis, I guess, about the developing a gas field that was so far being disputed between these two nations, and now they are sort of agreeing, at least on the level of a memorandum of understanding, to develop that jointly. And it's kind of all of them kind of coming together. That's why I thought maybe this is also something that we should weigh in. Lukas, do you see, is there any significance into that agreement that two sides have signed?
I think that it's a little bit more significant than the chat with the Taliban they had. Mm-hmm. Because this is probably the biggest issue at stake. How do you explore those offshore field located in the middle of the Caspian Sea. But again, the agreement that they made is for a relatively small field, if I'm not wrong, which, you know, obviously you need to have small step policy and try to work out things on the fast. But even here, I would question things like who's going to put the money, what kind of profit they're going to make, where they're going to export to. And we know the Caspian. The Caspian, you know, Dr. Pritchin is an expert here more than me. But in the Caspian context, getting things done has proven very difficult, if not impossible, in the last 25 years. Not only in terms of energy, but also in terms of shipping relationship and even on environmental issues. So maybe it's a little bit more positive, the outlook there, than the and in the Tapi field. But I would say that however encouraging this development is, it's very, very early days.
Let's see, Stanislav, what do you think about this? I mean, and so far what we have been saying whenever we spoke about the any sort of gas-related conversation in and around Caspian Sea, you know, this sort of a cold dispute between Azerbaijan and Turkmenistan would come up as a hurdle for implementation of any successful project there. But now it looks like two presidents are speaking to each other in terms which are reconciliatory to the point that they have agreed, at least on paper, to develop this gas field. I mean, what does that tell you about any future projects that might be taking place in and around Caspian Sea involving Turkmenistan?
I fully agree with my colleague that it was really very significant and absolutely unexpected, because this configuration of using this project and developing this project is being on the table probably more than 15 years. Azerbaijan long time ago suggested to Turkmenistan to develop this project together. Even 60% of this project, of money from this project, Turkmenistan could got from this. Azerbaijan was ready for such conditions, because for Azerbaijan this is additional resources for its pipeline system. And it just 20 kilometers from Azeri-Chirag-Guneshli project. And just it's really very limited investments from the point of view of its infrastructure, underwater infrastructure. And it's really was very unexpected for me that Turkmenistan finally agreed with these conditions. Of course, more probably Azerbaijan will be a technical operator and more probably financial operator of this project. And Turkmenistan just will get some money from after the starting this project and covering all investments. Politically, it's it looks like how Azeri media showed it, like another victory of Azeri diplomacy. After the Second Karabakh War, the status of Azerbaijan in region drastically increased, and it helped to finally to find this compromise with Turkmenistan.
Can we ask?
This is point of view of Azerbaijan. Of course, I think we have taken into account the difficulties with economy in Turkmenistan, and finally they agreed with this configuration of the project. It means for the future developments that more probably Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan agreed with the line of delimitation between the sectors in the Caspian Sea, and the only way which will have to resolve will be Iranian-Azerbaijanian border. Of course, we have memorandum about this, but a withdrawal of United States from the nuclear deal unfortunately blocked all the projects of development relations between Azerbaijan and Iran. But this is a very important tactics, using this common economic project to develop together this border oil and gas fields as an instrument for resolving border issues. And I agree with Bruce. He published a piece about the joining Turkmenistan to the South Gas Corridor. Of course, technically, this is the joining Turkmenistan of the South Gas Corridor, because reserves, Dostoluk project is very unique. This is not just oil. This is oil and gas reserve, where something about 50 million tons of oil and 30 billion cubic meters of gas. It means that Azerbaijan in the future can use this Turkmenian gas as the base for the South Gas Corridor.
Interesting.
But from the point of view of strategic and geopolitical issues, of course, this volume is very, very limited.
But
and this is not the future of the gas, South Gas Corridor.
Sure, but there is also, I cannot visualize the map of Caspian Sea as I'm sitting in the dark studio here, but there is also another gas field around that area that's called, from the Azerbaijani side, Kepaz, and Turkmens call it Serdar. I'm just...
They called it Dostoluk.
Okay.
It was a confrontation from the point of view of Turkmenistan, it was Serdar.
Mm-hmm.
From the point of view of Azerbaijan, it was Kepaz. And they agreed to call it Dostoluk, friendship, English.
Sorry for my ignorance. I was thinking maybe we are talking about two different projects here. So it is, we are talking about just one, and they call it now Dostoluk.
Yes, it's just one project.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for that. I know we are trying to squeeze so much into a short time frame today. Hopefully we will get back to it very soon. Bruce, since you have written a short piece about when this agreement was signed between Azerbaijani and Turkmenistani leaders, is there anything you would like to add that we might have missed in our conversation? And also, since that Azerbaijani Turkmenistanis are talking about energy cooperation in Caspian Sea, is there any hurdle in a way of Trans-Caspian pipeline finally being launched there?
Okay. Well, the first thing I would mention, and I just want to kind of follow up on a point that Stanislav made, was that, you know, right now, of course, we know that Turkmenistan's having economic problems. So, you know, that undoubtedly played a role in helping to convince the people in Ashgabat that they really needed to reach some kind of agreement in the middle of the Caspian. The economic situation in Turkmenistan probably won't last, which I suppose is good news for some of the Turkmen people. But you can't imagine that it'll last forever. And so I wonder if the Turkmen might, 10 years from now, might revisit this and look at this again and say, well, you know. Because right now the situation they're in is Azerbaijan is absolutely going to be the senior partner in this deal, and probably take most of the profits from it, because they deal with investors. They can find people to open up this field. They have the infrastructure right there. All the cards are in their hands. So the Turkmen will take what they can get now, but they might not be so happy with that down the line. Now, as far as an extension to make the Trans-Caspian pipeline, I know a lot of people think that certainly it does make it easier, right? Azerbaijan, as mentioned, has the infrastructure coming from the shore out into the sea already. So really, it's a question of the Turkmen building the pipeline from the Turkmen shore to the middle of the Caspian now. You know, but again, they're such a toxic country as far as foreign investors are concerned. This is going to be a problem. And Azerbaijan, I always mention, and every time I bring this up in a paper, that Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev mentioned, just a couple of years ago, after they signed the Caspian Convention, that if Turkmenistan was serious about building it, it should use some of its own money to build the pipeline. And we know that Turkmenistan has a lot of money in German banks and could fund the construction of the pipeline. But they also have not shown any inclination to do that. So, are they going to be able to find someone to do it? And then, of course, there's all kinds of other questions that come in. You would think, since Azerbaijan already has pipelines, no one could question Turkmenistan building their pipeline. But you never know. Once Turkmenistan starts construction, the Iranians might say something, the Russians might say something about what's going on there. And there's that clause, even in the convention, that, that all countries have a say in environmental, ecological, bioresource concerns in the Caspian. If one of them objects to it, it can slow things down or maybe even halt it altogether.
Thank you very much. Today we discussed Serdar's appointment to Vice Prime Minister's position, and now two topics in the energy sector. We tried to squeeze all of them together, but certainly, as I promised, we will get back to it very soon to talk about these things in details. But in the meantime, we need to conclude the discussion right here. But maybe just final points. So the way things stand today, where our eyes should be going forward. Let's start with you, Farouk. As a journalist, where your eyes will be going forward as to where we go after this stage in all these fronts that we discussed today?
We will have to watch what will happen during the March 28th election. And we have to mention that Serdar will turn 40 in September this year. Mm-hmm. And that will qualify him to become the president according to the constitution of Turkmenistan. Mm. Also, I would also mention that adding to Stanislav and Bruce's points that Turkmenistan is having problems, and they started admitting that they have problems, and the president himself is expressing dissatisfaction with how things are. And by the way, yesterday he appointed his son, but he also fired and appointed another one, the vice prime minister who is responsible for the energy sector. Murat Yildirim was fired. Turkmenistan is going through a very difficult time. The president himself is now admitting it. It is not very fortunate timing from their perspective, from the perspective of the Berdimuhamedov family, to change or to hand over the power. Mm-hmm. But we will have to watch these several events, the elections in March, and when Berdimuhamedov, the son, will turn 40.
Mm. It's a very interesting point that you brought up, Farouk. I mean, I guess after a long time, this was the first occasion where you would reward your energy officials, given at least something is happening, some discussion is taking place, apparently some progress are taking place, and now you just fire your energy minister. Sorry. So anyway, we need to end the conversation. Bruce, Stanislav, and Dr. Luca, just very briefly, where your eyes will be going forward following all these developments in Turkmenistan?
My eyes will go on the COVID situation. I think that international community has tolerated information control deception for too long. And from what I hear, it's getting really, really problematic there. So that's another issue which you may want to consider in assessing all of this. Yeah. What kind of support going on this regime can have? That's another issue.
Very interesting. Yeah, we missed that COVID situation there. So Stanislav, so where your eyes will be?
Of course, the health of the president, this is number one position. I fully agree with Bruce about rumors and really unexpected situation with this. And economy generally, because this, a lot of mistakes of the government brought a lot of problems generally for the people. And in situation when there is no any chances for population of Turkmenistan to achieve to the government with the problems, it creates a lot of problem for stability generally. And in Turkmenistan, unfortunately, probably the weakest player from the point of view of stability in Central Asia this year. But this year is a very significant 30 years from the getting independence. So in such circumstances, just my wishes to Turkmenistan to go through these problems without any problems, general problems for stability.
Bruce, finally yours.
Like I said, the energy problems, I don't see that there's been any significant shift in that. So I'm practically not going to pay any attention to what they say about TAPI and Trans-Caspian. I don't see it happening. I'm going to be really interested in seeing how much media time Serdar gets in the coming weeks. Because that'll probably tell us a lot about his father's health, too. If he gets 10 minutes of news or 15 minutes of the nightly news or something like that, then you got to figure the change is coming pretty soon.
That's terrific insight, Bruce. Thank you very much. I guess with this, we have to unfortunately conclude the discussion. We will get back to it, I promise. So thank you very much, Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlok OZ, Ready for Free Liberty Central Asia blog. Also, big thanks goes to Dr. Lukan Cisci, Central Asia Studies lecturer at the Glasgow University, Dr. Stanislav Prichin, senior researcher at the Institute of World Studies in Moscow, Farouk Yusupi, the director of Radio Free Press Liberties at Turkmen Service. Colleagues, thank you. Thank you very much for your time and thoughts today. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Press Liberties media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington. Until next week, bye-bye.